Welcome again to PBC. Well, you've come here this morning, probably, hopefully, to worship God. To worship a God that you have never seen. To worship a God that, for the most part, you've never heard speaking directly to you. To worship a God that is invisible and most of the world claims doesn't exist. And yet you claim to believe in him, and you're here to worship him, to gather together. If you remember last week, we talked about why religion, what's wrong with religion, what are the hard things about religion? And we talked about how religion can serve to actually protect us from that God that we claim to believe in, that religion can allow us to hide our hearts from that God. And the invitation before us was to actually turn to him, to actually believe in this living God that we claim to believe in. And yet, if you've been doing that for any length of time, you know that that's a complicated endeavor. It's not always easy, doesn't always work exactly as you expect it to. And so belief is hard, is difficult. A few years ago, the BBC did a special called the Atheism Tapes. It was a series of interviews hosted by a man named Jonathan Miller, who interviewed several very prominent atheists talking about why they didn't believe. Richard Dawkins, the author of The God Delusion, was among them. Another one was a man named Daniel Dennett, who's an American philosopher. He's written many books essentially trying to debunk the idea of a personal God. Well, I want us to watch a short clip from this interview with Daniel Dennett and see what he has to say about why belief is hard.
I don't think I encountered many people in my youth who really believed in God. I think most people who say they believe in God, most people in the West who say they believe in God, actually believe in belief in God. I don't even believe in belief in God. That is, they believe that belief in God is a really good thing. It is something to strive for, something to be maybe proud of if you succeed. Certainly you should try to believe in God, and you certainly shouldn't make it hard for others to believe in God. And the behavior of somebody who believes in belief in God is just the behavior we observe. You go to church, you sing hymns, you give money to the church, and so forth. If you actually believe in God, you do all sorts of lunatic things, and we don't see very many people doing those things. They don't put their lives on the line for God, typically. And I thought it was a little bit like belief in Santa Claus. It's something that we do. We talk about it. We sort of pretend to believe in God, and maybe the immature ones actually believe in God. And then some people grow out of it.
I thought it was a little ironic at the end he mentioned Santa Claus. Someone pointed out he might have a side job actually being Santa Claus. But he brings up the distinction between actually believing in God, and he says what most people do is believing in belief in God, that belief in God is a good thing, and we believe that, but do we actually believe in this personal living God? And most of the people in our world, most of the people we interact with, don't. They mostly, some of them might believe in belief in God or think it's a good thing, but a lot of people don't. We interact with people on a daily basis. For a lot of us, we've had our own questions and times where we've found it really hard to believe in God, to believe that this God, the way he reveals himself, is real and true and wants to have a relationship with us. And so for us, asking this question, why is God so hard to believe in, is important. Because we need to know, what is it that keeps us from believing in this God? I've had questions from a lot of college students lately. They're asking these types of questions, and one of the questions is, if God really wants us to believe in him, why does he make it so hard? It seems like God is trying to trip us up at times. Why isn't it more obvious if God is real? And those are tough questions. They're questions without easy answers. Well, to address this question, to kind of explore this, we're going to look at Jeremiah 2:9-13 this morning. It's on page 747 in the Bibles in your pews, if you want to follow along. And this is a passage about why God's people had a hard time staying with him. Why God's people had a hard time believing in him, and why they turned to other options instead. The tone of this passage is kind of shock and amazement that this could be the case, and yet unawareness that it's often the case. So let's look at this and see if we can kind of understand what makes faith in God difficult, and by doing that, be encouraged that we might grow in our faith and be able to support each other as well. We'll start by looking at this first verse. It kind of lays out, sets the scene for this passage. This is verse 9. "Therefore, I bring charges against you again, declares the Lord, and I will bring charges against your children's children." So this passage is set up, and the language used here is the language of a courtroom. These language of charges, that's a legal term. And the picture is of God hauling his people into court and accusing them of some wrongdoing. The context of this passage is of God discussing how previous generations of his people were true to him. They followed him. And yet this latest generation seems to have a hard time. They seem to have given up on him. So he brings them into court and he accuses them of that. But as we follow the passage, we realize it's not just any court. The court here in session is that you could call it a divorce court. Because what's happening is it's not a judge bringing in some person in the civil environment, charging him with a crime. It's not an employer bringing in an employee saying you're doing a bad job. It's a husband calling in his spouse, his bride, accusing her of deserting him. So what's at stake here is a relationship, not a system of beliefs. Notice the title of this message is not "Why is Christianity hard to believe in?" It's not about this set of beliefs. It's not about belief in God. It's about the relationship, actually believing in God. So let's see how this plays out. We have the courtroom. Let's read the first section to see what happens here. We're going to read verses 10 and the first part of 11. "Cross over to the coasts of Kittim and look. Send to Kedar and observe closely. See if there has ever been anything like this. Has a nation ever changed its gods? Yet they are not gods at all." So the first thing that happens in this courtroom is that witnesses are called for. God says, go out and see if you can find somebody to testify to what is happening here. He says, go to Kittim. That's to the west of Israel, referring to the Greek islands. He says, go to Kedar. That's an area to the east of Israel. What he's saying is, go everywhere. Go east, go west, look all around and see if you can find anybody anywhere who's seen something like this happening. The implication is that you can't. What's happening here, what Israel is doing to their God, is unheard of. They're worshiping gods that they made up. And what it says, and the implication here, is that these nations, the nations that Israel are following, have made up these idols, they're worshiping these gods, and they are more faithful to those idols than Israel is to her God. The nations are more faithful to these things that aren't even gods at all than Israel is to the God that created them and sustains them and loves them. And that's really challenging. What about our culture? Do we see that at all? You know, we certainly, in our culture, follow lots of gods. People follow the gods of money, of success, of achievement. And if you look around, I think you'll notice that people are incredibly faithful to these gods. At times, they put us to shame. These things that aren't gods at all, they stick with them through thick and thin, even when things don't work out. And yet, faith in our God seems tentative at times. Take money, for example. We as a culture are fixated on money. We're built around money. We work so we can earn money, so that we can go have fun spending money. That's our lives are built around earning and spending money. That's how we think of things. And people are faithful to this idea that money is going to get them what they want. And yet, if you get them alone, if you ask somebody in a quiet moment, Do you really think that money is going to make you happy? Do you really think it's going to get you what you want out of life? Most people, when they're honest, will say no. I know that's not the case. And yet you observe how we as a culture treat money, how we work for it, how we are obsessed with it. And you say, boy, we're really faithful to a God that we don't actually believe in. It's amazing. You know, we're in the midst of an economic crisis where people are losing money and losing jobs. And are people saying, you know, maybe this God of money thing, maybe it's not working out. Maybe we should look for another God. No, nobody's saying that. They're saying we need to find a way to make this God work. We need to fix the economy. We need to generate jobs. We need to generate more money. We need to make this money thing work. This desperate attempt to kind of make this idol work for us. So why is that? Why are we so faithful to other gods? I think one reason is that we want control. We want control over our lives. See, when we talk about worshiping money, it's not this kind of picture of completely greedy, you know, nothing else matters, all I want to do is make money. Most people in our world aren't like that. It's not the Ebenezer Scrooge picture that we see kind of caricaturized on TV or in movies. Most people we meet are nice and friendly, and they're working hard. But see, worshiping something means believing that that thing is going to give you life. The things that you want out of life, some sense of purpose, some time for recreation, some time with family, some way to provide for people. Those are the things we want out of life, and those are good desires. The question is, what is it that gets us those things? What is it that gives us life? And for most people in our culture, the answer is money. Money is the thing that's going to make you okay. Not entirely. For some people, it's position or power or education or achievement. But a lot of those things come back to money. And so the question is, what do you look to for life? And money is something that promises you control, control over what you want. And this is what was true for the Israelites as well. See, they went after Baal, they went after the other gods, because these gods promised them control over their lives. They promised them, if you'll do this, you'll have control, you'll be able to get what you want. The kind of crazy thing is they didn't deliver. Of course, these idols didn't give them any sense of control, and yet they promised them control, which makes it all that amazing how faithful they were to them. And what we can observe is that we, as people, are more faithful to something that promises us control than something that offers us provision, someone who offers to love us and take care of us, but doesn't always give us control in the matter. That's how much we love control. And so we want control, but God says, I won't give you control, but I'll provide for you. I'll be good to you. I'll love you. I'll give you life. And yet God's people say, we'd rather the idol that promises us control, even if we're not sure it can deliver. That's what we'll choose. Well, the courtroom continues. They've sent out looking for witnesses, and apparently they can't find any witnesses that will testify to what Israel has done as being a normal thing. So the prosecutor takes the stand, and he makes his charge. This is the indictment. Listen to the second half of 11 and verse 12. But my people have exchanged their glory for worthless idols. Be appalled at this, O heavens, and shudder with great horror, declares the Lord. So the charge has been made, and the charge is that God's people have given up their relationship with God for the sake of something else. They've left their God. They've cheated on their husband. They've violated that relationship. And this phrase, exchanging glory, is kind of an interesting one. It appears several times in Scripture. One of the places is in Psalm 106, 20. And in that place, the psalm is referring specifically to an incident earlier in Israel's history when God had led them out of Egypt, and then they traded God for a golden calf. They exchanged their glory for a golden bull that they could worship, Psalm 106 says. And it makes me kind of think about that story because it's a good illustration of this idea of exchanging their glory. And I've thought back about that story at times, and it's kind of amazing to me. I mean, you have this people that are slaves in Egypt, and they witness God doing amazing things. They witness these plagues where their enemies suffer at their God's hand. The final plague they witness, the firstborn of all the Egyptians die. And yet they and their families are miraculously spared. And then God leads them out of Egypt. They get to the water. The water splits for them and they walk across on dry land. And then they see their enemies following them. And what happens? The waters close and God wipes them out. They get to a mountain and they hear God speaking through the thunder, inviting Moses up. And Moses goes up to meet with this God of theirs. And then he takes a little too long. And they go, forget it. Forget this God. I'd much rather a calf made of gold that I can worship. And I listen to that story and I think, really? Is your faith that weak that, you know, a little too long on the mountain and you're ready to give up this whole thing? It seems amazing. And yet, then I look at myself, my own life, and I think, well, I'm not really that different. I've seen God at work in my life. I've seen him do things that are miraculous, that things that give evidence to his reality in my life. I've seen him change me. I've seen him call me to him, introduce me to his love and forgiveness. I've seen him change my marriage. I've seen him change my heart for him and for other people. I've seen him answer specific prayers. And yet he makes me wait a little bit and I go, forget it. I'm tired of this. And it's amazing that I'm willing so quickly to exchange the glory of this personal relationship with God for a worthless idol, for something else that's never going to deliver. Why is God so hard to believe in? Well, one reason is that we explain him away. We take these examples of him moving in miraculous ways in our lives and we say it's something else. You got to realize for the ancient Israelites, they experience these incredible supernatural evidences of God. And, you know, I look at those and I say, if I saw half of those things, my faith would be rock solid. I would never doubt God if I'd gone through those things. And yet you have to realize they had alternative explanations in their culture as well. See, Pharaoh's magicians replicated half of these plagues. And to them, you know, the water splitting, that could have been a natural phenomenon. That could have been Baal, for all they know. This mountain, the thunder, I mean, they thought other gods did that too. What we realize is that God's people throughout all cultures have opportunities to explain him away through alternative explanations. We always have the chance to look at what God does, to how he represents himself. We always have the opportunity to say, it wasn't really God. It was something else. We explain God away. I'd like to ask you to stop for a second and think about your own journey with God, what that's looked like. Think about your childhood or about when you first encountered God, what that looked like. Think about different times where you've experienced God in very real ways. And yet, is it still tough? Do you still find yourselves going, well, maybe that wasn't really God? I know I do. I think, well, maybe I just kind of grew up. Maybe I grew out of those hard things. Maybe my marriage, maybe we just kind of got used to being married and things got easier. Maybe that thing was a coincidence. It wasn't really answered prayer. And yet what's amazing is that God is still there, still working in our lives. I don't know about you, but if I kept doing something over and over again and somebody else kept getting credit for it, I'd probably stop doing that thing. I'd go, forget it. If you're not going to acknowledge that I'm doing it, I'm out. What's amazing is that God's still there, still at work. Even when we explain him away, he's still working in our lives, still making himself real, inviting us to know him more. Well, the court's been set up. The witnesses have been called. Nobody showed up. Prosecution made his charge. And now we get to the climax of the scene. We get to the verdict. We get to the final conclusion. This occurs in verse 13. My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. So here's the conclusion of the matter. God's people are found guilty. They have forsaken their God. They've deserted their husband. Now I want to ask you to think about times when maybe you've been in some romantic relationship. Maybe it's a dating relationship. Maybe it was a marriage. And you've been broken up with. And this hasn't happened to you. Maybe some of your friends, or you've talked through people in this situation. And the pain of having somebody say, I don't want to be with you anymore. But think about when we hear that, when somebody says to us, I don't want to be with you anymore, what's our first thought? The first thought is, well, is there someone else? Would you rather be with someone else? Is that why you don't love me anymore? And that makes it that much harder to know that not only is this person not choosing me, but they're choosing someone else over me. And that's what God says his people are doing. They've traded him for someone else. Not only deserted, but they've been adulterous. The image God uses for himself is one of living water, this kind of source, this spring of running water. In that culture, they're very familiar with water and how essential water was to living, to having any type of civilization. And they knew that when you're looking for water, you look for running water. You look for water that's moving. That's what the living water literally means, water that's running. If you've ever been outside or you've backpacked or been at times where you need water, you know that if you're going to drink water outside, don't go to a muddy pond. Go to a stream, something running where the water is moving. There's less chance for bacteria and other bad things to be in there. That's what's safe. And the Israelites knew this. That God uses this imagery to kind of evoke that in them, to say, I am living water. I am the source of clean, pure life. And yet, what did they do? They dug out cisterns. See, now a cistern is usually a big hole in the ground that you dig out and you line it with rocks or gravel or tar, something to make it watertight. You collect rainwater in this cistern, and then you use it later when you need water. The problem is, cisterns collected water, they held it, and the water pretty quickly got pretty disgusting. There were other types of cisterns too, above ground tanks or sometimes pots. Large pots could be referred to as cisterns. The problem is, standing water in one place goes bad. It's not a great source of water. And yet God's people say, we'd prefer that. And not only cisterns, but broken cisterns. Not only does the water go bad, but they don't even hold the water. It's leaking out. And yet that's more attractive than the spring of living water. And you have to ask why. Why do God's people prefer broken cisterns? I think one reason is that the cistern is a known quantity. See, I build a cistern. I dig it out. I create it. I shape it. Whatever it is, I know about it. I understand it. It's under my control. If a cistern breaks, well, I fixed it. I made it. I can fix it. It collects water, and I can see the water, and I know when it's going to be there. I can manage a cistern. A spring, on the other hand, you have to know where it is. Springs are hard to find. Once you find them, springs change. They develop. Sometimes they're there. Maybe next year it'll be gone. Who knows? It's unpredictable. Sure, it's better water, but it's just trickier. It's more complicated. And this is what we want from God. We want a God that we can manage, that we can understand. We want answers. We want answers. See, for the Israelites, worshiping Baal made sense. He gave them something they could understand. You do these rituals, you worship this idol, and you get what you want. And for us, it's the same way. If you talk to people that are having a hard time believing in God, that are struggling with him, a lot of them will say, well, I've got this question. I don't have an answer. And for a lot of us, that's what often derails us. Questions without answers. I want to know why. I want to know how. What about this? What about history? What about this friend of mine? I want answers, and God doesn't give me answers. So I'd rather this cistern thing that I can grasp than a God who doesn't always give me answers to my questions. There's a series on NPR called This I Believe. They recently did kind of a variation on this series called This I Used to Believe. And it kind of interviewed a bunch of people who had recently lost or changed significant beliefs in their lives. One of them was a young woman who had recently given up belief in God. She was being interviewed, and she explained that she had a friend who recently died of cancer. And this was a really hard experience for her. When that happened, she desperately wanted to know why. Why did this happen? And she said, I found that attributing it to nothing, having an answer of meaninglessness, gave me more comfort than the idea of a God that wouldn't tell me why this happened. See, for her, she'd rather this painful answer that nothing happens for a reason, that nobody's in charge, that this is just a random tragedy, that gave her more comfort because she could grasp it than the idea of a God who would be with her, who would care for her, who would give her himself, but who may not ever answer the question, why did this happen? She preferred a broken cistern to a source of living water. And we're often the same way. So one of these reasons that God is so hard to believe in is that he's complicated. He doesn't always answer our questions. Believing with him is going to leave us with open questions. I can almost guarantee you that. You might not know why certain things happen in your life. You might not know what about all the terrible things that have been done in the name of Christianity. You might not know about some of those questions that just stay in the back of your minds. And yet, God gives us himself. He gives us his presence. He comes with us. He enters into those times with us. He allows us to ask him those questions face to face and say, God, I want to know the answer. He allows us to beat on his chest. And he's there with us. He gives us himself, but we'd rather answers. We'd rather grasp it all, get our minds around it. What amazes me is that this thing that makes God hard to believe in is actually one of the things that, in my mind, testifies most powerfully to his truth, to his reality. Because, see, think of it this way. If I sat down tomorrow and decided I was going to create a religion, and I was going to write a book about a God, and I had these great aspirations that people all over the world would follow this God, and I would start a world religion, well, I'm pretty sure it wouldn't look like this. And I'm pretty sure it wouldn't be like Christianity. I'm pretty sure I'd come up with a God that was pretty easy to believe in. I'd come up with a God that makes sense. I'd come up with a God that all the dots just connected. And, you know, if you just look at this diagram, you could understand God. That's what I would do. Of course, I'm an engineer, so that's kind of my bent. But I would have a nice little picture of God that you could all grasp, and we'd go along on our way feeling happy that we understood God. And so the fact that that God isn't portrayed in this book, the fact that the God we see here leaves us with open questions, leaves us with things we don't understand about him, asks us to enter into hard times, that to me means people probably didn't make this God up. Because that's not the type of God we really want. And so the very fact that God is shrouded in mystery makes me think, well, maybe he's actually God and not a figment of my imagination or some projection of my emotional needs. The fact that I pray to him and I don't always get exactly what I want, maybe that means he's actually God and he knows better and he gives me what he knows I need because he loves me. So the very thing that makes God hard to believe in also testifies that this might actually be God we're dealing with. Well, so this is why God's people prefer cisterns. They want something that they can understand. They want answers. But why is it that living water isn't more attractive to us? Why do we reject what we really desire? Clean, fresh water that gives life. I think part of the answer is because we're afraid to hope. We look at this thing of living water, we look at this promise, and we say, well, sounds nice, but too good to be true. And I have too much at stake to lose if I bank on that and it turns out not to be true. In John 4, we get a story of a woman who's talking with Jesus, a Samaritan woman who talks with Jesus. And when she realizes that Jesus wants to talk about God's stuff, she goes, great, I've got a bunch of questions that I want answers for. What about this? What about the temple? What about my people? What about these things? And Jesus says, I don't want to give you answers to your questions. How about living water? How about I give you a source of living water that will well up in you, giving you life and life to others? And once she kind of figures out what he's talking about, she says, yes, yes, I want that. But a lot of us are too afraid to respond the way she did. A lot of us feel like we have too much to lose, that if we hope in this living water thing, if we bank on that, it's just too risky. As a lot of us are afraid of being disappointed. See, we've been disappointed in the past. We've hoped for things. We've wanted things to be true, and it hasn't been true. And the idea that living water might be true is great, but it's risky. And it leaves us open for disappointment. But I'm convinced when we're honest, we all struggle with that notion of being afraid that God is going to let us down, being afraid that he'll disappoint us. It may encourage us to know that Jeremiah had the same struggle. Listen to what he says in Jeremiah 15. This is Jeremiah 15, 18. He says, why is my pain unending and my wound grievous and incurable? Speaking to God, he says, will you be to me like a deceptive brook, like a spring that fails? See, Jeremiah had written these words that God said, I am their spring of living water. And yet later on, he goes to God and he says, aren't you going to let me down just like everything else has let me down? Aren't you going to be a spring that fails? I'm so scared of being disappointed. Can I really hope? Is this really true? Have you found yourself wondering that? Afraid to bank on this God? As Daniel Dennett said, believing that, you know, believing in belief in God is a lot safer. That's a lot easier. There's a lot less to lose in that. But believing in God is too risky. It's too much at stake. But the Christian story, the story that the scriptures present, is a forward-moving story. It's a story of hope, of redemption, of something coming that's worth hoping for. It's all about hope. It's all about what God is doing, this new work that he's inviting us into, the spring of living water that meets our desires, the things that we want, the things that are so deep in our hearts that we are afraid to think that there might be an answer for them someday. That's what God's doing. He wants to be that in our lives. Zechariah 14 describes the new Jerusalem. He's talking about the final work of God's redemption, when all things will be made new, when God's people will live on a remade earth in his presence, enjoying life as it was meant to be. And he describes it like this. On that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half to the eastern sea and half to the western sea, in summer and in winter. The city we live in, the New Jerusalem, will have living water at its core. A spring, a fountain, providing for our needs, giving us our heart's desires. And to the world, east and west, in summer, in winter, all the time, everywhere, living water for those who believe in God. Something worth hoping in. Now, the truth is, we find it hard to hope. And what's beautiful about our God is that he's gentle. He invites us to hope over and over again, saying, I know it sounds too good to be true, but believe me. Follow me. I know you have a hard time. I know you're worried about disappointing. And so he's gentle, careful with us, luring us, wooing us to himself. We're afraid to hope, but God gives us hope gently and carefully. So here I am, here we are, worshiping God, trying to believe in this God that at times we find really hard to believe in, and yet wanting to engage with Him, wanting to turn to Him, wanting to actually believe in God, not just be believing in belief in God. And we know that God could call us into court, accuse us of deserting Him, and we know that those things are true of us. It's really true for me. I'm amazed at my own relationship with God, how easy it is to just forget about Him and just to turn to some cheap imitation for the things that I think I want in life. I was thinking about this last night. I was kind of overwhelmed by this sense of how quickly I turn from God, thinking about some of these themes and realizing I think I need to hear this sermon that I'm preaching tomorrow. I think I need to know how to believe in God, how to actually turn to Him, to be changed by Him. But the beautiful thing is that that's not the end of the story. God could haul us into court, but He doesn't. What does He do? He sends His Son, who is obedient, who is faithful, who is true to Him, and He hauls His Son into court. And His Son hangs on a cross and asks, my God, why have you forsaken me? When I've been true, when I've been faithful. And yet even as Jesus asks that question, He knows the answer. God divorces Him. He sends Him away, turns Him out of His presence so that He can welcome us back into His presence. Because our faith is weak, we turn from Him, and so God makes up our lack. He gives us faith. He calls to us. He helps us believe. And that's incredibly encouraging. You know, as we've talked about why God is hard to believe in, our answers haven't had to do with God. They've had to do with ourselves. We want answers. We want control. We explain Him away. We're afraid to hope. So is it really God that's hard to believe in, or is it us that have a hard time believing in God? And I think the answer is our hearts. We just find it hard to believe in God. So if you feel that way, if you've felt that way, my prayer is that this might be challenging but also encouraging to know that the saints from old have felt this way, to know that we feel this way, and to know that even in that failure, God meets us. He offers us hope. He restores us. He invites us closer to Him. Doesn't mean that it's easy to believe in God. I think if it's easy to believe in God, then it might not be God you're believing in. But it does mean that He's faithful, that He is true to us, that He gives us Himself, that He invites us to hope, that He reaches out to us, and He wants us to respond to Him. Our hearts are fickle, but He is living water. He meets our needs. Thank God for that. Let me pray. Father, thank You that You do reach out to us. Thank You that even when we find it hard to believe in You, that You don't give up on us, that You are faithful to us, even when we are faithless. That You give us faith, that You call to us, that You constantly show up in our lives, that You love us, and You want us to be in deep relationship with You. I pray that we would be given the courage to respond to You, that we'd be able to hope, that we'd be able to trust that You're real, trust that You'll provide even without answers, and trust that the good things You have for us are real, and that we could be encouraged by that. Thank You for that promise. We pray these things in the name of Your Son, who makes it possible for us to come to You. In His name, amen.